Magic Lessons is supported in part by Audible.com. Audible content includes more than 250,000 audio programs from leading audiobook publishers, broadcasters, entertainers, magazines, and newspaper publishers, and business information providers. Audible content is downloaded and played back on your smartphone, portable device, or PC. Magic Lessons listeners might enjoy Navel Gazing, True Tales of Bodies, Mostly Mine, But Also My Mom's, which I know sounds weird. It's by Michael Ian Black, the incredible comedian, actor, and writer, who is also one of my guests this season on the podcast. Audible is offering Magic Lessons podcast listeners a free 30-day trial membership. Just go to audible.com/lessons and choose from over 250,000 titles and start listening. It's that easy. Go to audible.com/lessons. That's audible.com/lessons and get started today. Just a heads up, everybody, these are adults having adult conversations, so there is the possibility of adult language. Hi, everyone, and welcome to Magic Lessons, a podcast produced by MaximumFun.org. I'm Elizabeth Gilbert, and last year I wrote this book called Big Magic, Creative Living Beyond Fear. But even when I was finished with the book, I was definitely not finished with the topic because I'm still as much as ever fascinated with the intricacies of the creative process and how we find our way through that strange journey, the obstacles we meet along the way, and the joy of what we ultimately create. And it is through my desire to keep having that conversation that this, the Magic Lessons podcast, was born. So here we are. Season 2, and we are back with more real conversations with real people, amateurs and experts. This season, we will be meeting poets and novelists, dancers, photographers, comedians, and whether they're ready or not, me and my friends are going to help them figure out how to shake off their fear, get unstuck, and start making stuff. You know why? Because I think they are ready. So let's go. Today, I'm calling Colleen in New York City.
Hello.
Hi, is that Colleen?
Hi, is that Liz?
Yes, it is. Were you expecting my call?
I was. I'm so happy to hear from you. It's Big Magic Day.
It is Big Magic Day, and I'm so excited to meet you because I loved your essay, and man, I want you to do this thing that you want to do. I want you to do it so bad. And that's what we're going to work on today. So I know your backstory. Nobody else does. So if you don't mind, I'm going to ask you if you might read the original essay that you sent to me, the one that made you stand out to me and made me want to help you. Can you find it?
Sure.
Cool.
Okay, here goes.
Okay, go for it.
I'm a writer and a storyteller disguised as an advertising executive. I'm working on a one-woman show about growing up the youngest of six in an Irish Catholic family. My parents owned a bar. Mom greeted the customers, and Dad was the entertainment. My parents and the bar are gone, but the five siblings and the stories remain. I want to tell them, but, and here's the thing, I'm totally paralyzed. Fear, grief, disbelief. What if it's not good enough? Does anybody care about this? I know it sounds like what Ms. Lamott calls radio K-fucked. I want to become unstuck. I could use some big magic.
First of all, we have to back up and explain what Radio K-Fucked is because it's so good. It's an Anne Lamott trope about the voice in your head, that terrible radio antenna that she calls Radio K-Fucked that broadcasts 24 hours a day information about what a piece of garbage you are.
Right. And it's been on blast.
And it's been on full blast. And we all have it. And I love that you reference that. It's so good. Okay, so I'm sure, Colleen, that having grown up in a bar with six kids in a large Irish Catholic family, you don't have any interesting stories. I can't imagine.
They're very dull.
I can't imagine a single fascinating thing that would have happened in your childhood. And actually, on that note, what I wanted was if you could just fill in more, like tell me about that. Tell me about your family and about your parents and about that incredibly particular and specific upbringing that you had.
Yeah, you know, I grew up in the suburbs of Philadelphia, and it's full of first and second generation families, mostly, or a lot of Irish and a lot of Italian.
Yep.
And I also went to Catholic school, so all my classmates were either Maureens and Eileens and Aileens or Teresas and Francescos and all this kind of stuff. So it's almost really insular to grow up in because we didn't really understand that the outside world. It was like the Catholics and the publics
is
what we grew up in.
Right.
And having the bar, you know, kind of set my family out a little bit because on the one hand, you know, my dad was like the mayor of every town he ever walked into. So he knew everybody, knew every cop in three counties and everything else. But also it was a little weird. It was like a little kind of like, they own a bar. Is that okay? I don't know. They have a lot of kids. Are these kids good? Are they not good? You know, and I love
the idea, by the way, that like somebody in your community was like, wait, this big Irish family owns a bar. That's so outrageous.
Like we were removed enough from like the actual motherland to be like, I don't know, this is America now, guys.
Oh, right.
We should walk away from those tropes, you
right,
know? Like,
right.
You know, we all had to work there. And some of my older siblings worked there until the bar was closed. They worked there always. But the rest of us did our rotations through. And there was all these moments of me being like kind of embarrassed about the bar and embarrassed that it was a thing. Because I kind of had all these like, you know, third and fourth generation American friends who didn't even know where they came from.
Right.
They were like, I don't know.
Right.
Europe? I don't know.
Yeah.
And me being like, oh, no, you know, we've got the whole, like, the Irish flags and everything else going on over here, and the Irish dancers, I had to take Irish dancing lessons and all that stuff. So I think that really informed me kind of, like, launching myself into my, quote-unquote, real life, like my post-childhood life in New York and, you know, getting what my parents would call a good job.
Uh-huh,
you know?
Uh-huh.
And my siblings, you know, we're all really close, but we also are all almost separated by, like, a generation because there's so many of us.
Right.
We span, like, a 13-year span. So it's really fascinating to see kind of their perspective on how we grew up versus mine.
Right. Different
you know?
Generation. Your parents took their Catholicism seriously, Colleen.
Oh, they were not kidding.
they delivered, man. tell me about what happened in your family recently, because I know that there's been sort of an earthquake of grief, it sounds like.
Yes. Both my parents have passed. And or I should say they died. Like maybe not use a euphemism. They're now dead. So, which is like I've gained entry into that worst club, the dead parents club.
Yeah.
It's like the worst. And they died like 4 years apart. So not super close together, but also just we were just sort of settling down from losing my dad.
Mm-hmm.
And this is actually when I first got the idea to write and to like tell these stories. And then I was kind of in a momentum, and then my mother got sick, and everything fell apart. We thought it was bad losing dad, like that was the worst, and losing my mother was like, wait, what? It can get worse?
Oh my God.
So
it's always so dangerous to say it can't get worse than this.
it's
such a dangerous thing to say because the universe is like, let's see what we
can
do.
exactly.
Let's test that theory. And you said that you lost a momentum. So before your father or around the time that your father passed away, you were on your way to creating something about your family. Is that right?
Right. I had this this vision of myself. I don't know where it hadn't been ever there before, but I had this vision of me standing on a stage in front of a microphone telling stories.
Mm-hmm.
And it just sort of like popped into my head. And this was actually like storytelling, I'm sure you know, has become kind of a movement in a lot of the major cities. And it's sort of become a thing.
Yeah.
But I didn't know that like 5 years ago. I had never really heard of it as an art form. And I remember saying to somebody, I had this weird vision of myself doing this like storytelling thing. And she goes, yeah, that's the thing. You can take a class on that. You can like go sign up at the story studio and take a class. And I was like, oh, great. So I did that. And it was amazing. I loved it. It was so fun. And so, you know, it was kind of about going in deep and finding all these great things. And I took the class and I ended up being lucky enough to be asked to be on a podcast to tell one of my stories.
Wow.
And it was really, like, I just felt like I had so much, I was going for it. I was like, this is great, this is amazing, I'm going to totally do this. And then it was, like, full stop.
And it was full stop because your mother got sick?
Yeah.
Yeah. And how long ago was that again?
Well, she died 2 years ago.
Yeah.
So it's about 3 years ago now that happened.
And every day you think about doing this?
Yeah.
I'm just taking a wild guess.
Yeah.
And tell me, having had the experience of having done it, the experience of having been noticed and recognized enough to be, you know, brought into a space where people wanted to hear the story, and having had the experience of the joy of it, why won't you let yourself do that again?
Oh, that's such a good question. I really think that for a while I was mute. I felt like I couldn't get words out. And then I just felt really scared. Like, talking about all this stuff makes it real. Like, maybe it was a bad dream.
Oh, I see.
But it's not real.
Right. Because you mean talking about your family and your parents dying and...
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. Right. Right. Interesting. Okay. We're going to start taking this apart. Ready?
Yep. Are you going to tell me it's not a dream?
First of all, Colleen, there are things that I may be worried about for you. You being mute is not one of them.
Point taken.
So I'm not totally convinced that muteness is the issue, right? I'm just not. Like, I've been on the phone with you for 7 minutes. I'm like, this chick can talk. Like, she's not. And she's born to talk. And as somebody who is also born to talk, like, you know, I know what I'm looking at and I know what I'm hearing. And I think, of course, the bigger fear is fear itself. Mm-hmm. And at the beginning of this conversation, you said something about your, and you used this exact phrase, your quote-unquote real life.
Mm-hmm.
So before we talk about your quote-unquote real life, tell me what your quote-unquote real life looks like.
I live in New York City. I've been here for 22 years, so I consider myself a real New Yorker now. I work for a big advertising agency, so I have a kind of a pretty big job there, which is very kind of, it's great. It gives me a lot of perks and a lot of experiences and everything. I'm grateful for a lot of it, but it's very stressful. It's very consuming. Outside of work, you know, I have a very close network of friends, and my family's pretty close by, so I really tend to spend a lot of time with them. I tend to travel a lot and basically just try to make time for things that are not work, which is in itself kind of an activity.
I'm going to ask you a question that might sound really weird, but just roll with me with it, okay? Are you afraid of your job? Are you afraid of going to work every day? Do you get terrified when you wake up in the morning and think, oh my God, I have to go to work and sit at that desk? Do you get panicked and paralyzed? Or do you just go?
Well, I think it's a little of both.
Uh-huh.
I kind of push down on that and just go, you know, but I do feel a lot of times at odds with that life.
The reason that I'm asking you this is because of a question that I have not just for you, but lately for me and for a lot of other people as well, which is, why is the thing that brings you joy scarier than the thing that brings you drudgery?
Yeah, that's...
You know, when people start talking about the thing they really want to be doing with their life, and I wish, what I wish I could do if I were a really fast, super splicing sound engineer, is just take your voice... register from the way you were talking about your job, which you laid out as if you were reading it off a legal pad. You were like, I have a job. I go to my job. It has good perks and benefits. I am grateful for my job. Like almost robot voice, you know? And then like just compare it register to register against your voice when you were talking about what it was like to be on stage and to tell those stories and to be on the radio and to be heard and to take that class where your voice suddenly became champagne voice. Right? Like just full of light and bubble and air, you know, and joy. And so one of them, and I'm not telling you, and I never tell anyone to do this, I'm not telling you to quit your job. What I just want to do is hold those two up against each other and ask you, why do you consider the item on the left, the legal pad where you're reciting the benefits and the perks of your job in a very flat monotone voice? I want to know why the joyful, effervescent champagne Colleen is scarier to you than going to your job.
Mm-hmm.
Why is joy more frightening to people than its reverse?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not asking you because I know the answer, because I don't. And I don't because so many of us do this, you know?
Yeah.
And why, this is my even bigger question, why is the flat monotone reading it off a legal pad, why is that your real life? You know it isn't because you put it in quotes.
Right.
You know, like you put it in quotes. You said, quote unquote, that my real life. Because even you somewhere know that that's not where your real self abides. And it's what society and culture and tradition call a real life. But it's not where you're really alive. So it's not your real life. It's something that you do and have to do and we all have to do in order to, you know, kind of pay bills and get by. But I think you know what your real life is. And I wonder why it's scarier for you than not doing it.
I think my real response to that is that putting myself out there as just that non-work thing somehow makes me feel like I'm not a credible, responsible person who realized their potential of being first generation college and all that.
Jesus,
stuff.
Colleen, you sound like a fucking guidance counselor right now. Like every time you drop into that register of credible, responsible person who finally, like, your whole being changes. And I'm like, who is that? Who is that voice? And who is that voice? Who did you get that voice from? Why is that voice in you that insists that that's what it means to be responsible? And I will remind you that the definition of responsible is the ability to respond. The definition of responsible is not how many hours you put into the work week, but how well as a human being you are capable of responding to life. That's my definition of responsible.
Yeah.
Able to respond. You know, but I want to know whose voice is speaking through you, like as if you're a sock puppet, when you start saying that that's what it means to be an adult.
Yeah, I have this voice in my head that says, don't quit your day job all the time. I think I got that from my family, my parent. I mean, I don't want to blame them, of course, but I think that's the culture we grew up in. We grew up in that culture of up and out, and I think that's where I get it from. And I've held on to it like grim death.
Grim death. Now we're getting somewhere. Okay, so here's my question: did you quit your day job when you did your first foray into storytelling?
No.
So you don't have to.
No, yeah.
So you know you don't have to.
Right.
So you can appease that parental voice while at the same time being real Colleen. And the real Colleen, you know who that is because you saw her in a vision and you even called it a vision.
Mm-hmm.
And when you get a glimpse of yourself like that, that's where it's at. You know,
yeah.
Like that image that you had of yourself standing on stage in front of a microphone telling stories was a glimpse of the future. You know, I think sometimes our future selves actually send back like these cosmic messages. They send back these little images as though from satellite from outer space saying, hey, take a look. You know, this is where we're going to end up. Now, what are you going to do today to get us there? And I'm just reminding you that that's our destiny. We're going to be there. And that's what you know to be true. And what I want you to stop doing is calling your real life your real life. I want you to start calling that your fake life. And it's okay. Look, we all have fake lives. Prostitution is an old and very respectable tradition. We all do it.
Yeah.
You know, we all do it in various ways. There's nothing to be ashamed of about it, but call it what it is. Call it what it is. And call your real life by its true name. And that is what Colleen wants to be doing with her short and sparkling moment on this earth. And what your destiny is, I believe. I want you to write this word down if you have a piece of paper.
Mm-hmm.
The word is called, and I'm going to mispronounce it terribly because guess what? I don't speak Gaelic. The word is S-E-A-N-C-H-A-I. So it looks like it says Sean Chai, but it is apparently pronounced something like Shaunachie. And all the Irish speakers out there are rolling in their graves with bottles of whiskey rolling around them. But this is an ancient word, and this is a word for a mystical and almost mythological storyteller. This is the storytelling tradition of Ireland is based in that word. So when you said at the beginning of this conversation, storytelling has become a thing, not lately, honey. Like I know lately it's like we've got the moth and we've got StoryCorps and we've got people storytelling. It's not become a thing. It has always been a thing. And it is your particular cultural inheritance because you are Irish.
Right.
And you are the Irish daughter of an Irish goddamn bartender. You know, like you are so deeply rooted in that tradition that it is totally who and what you are. And what happens to Colleen when she doesn't get to be that person is grim death. You said it yourself, you know. And I want you to look that word up and I want you to study that tradition and find out where you come from and ask yourself if perhaps that is who you are, that you are a modern day Shaunachie, that you are here to stand in the light and the responsibility of those people. And here we go back to what responsibility means, right? Those people were given a responsibility and their responsibility was the guardian of the tale. the guardian of the tale in a pre-literate society. They were incredibly important. No laws could exist without their memory. You know, no history could exist without their memory. People didn't know who they were without these people standing there telling them their stories. That's what you're for. That's what you're for. And as the youngest, you were particularly placed to see all the stories.
Yeah.
And to observe them all. And it's, I mean, if you want to be responsible, the way you be responsible is to take those stories out into the world.
I love that. I love that. I love that. I love that. Because I think that the idea that that was a thing that
was
so necessary.
A sacred duty.
Yes, it was a duty. And
that's,
I think, where the struggle has been. I felt like it's frivolous.
Oh, God,
for me
no.
to want to do this. And it's not. It's so important.
Oh, my God. Okay, so you've read your Frank McCourt, I hope. Have you read Frank McCourt? Okay, so Frank McCourt, who wrote Angela's Ashes. I want you to go back and read that book again. I don't know when the last time you read it was. I know I read it in 96.
Yeah, I think me too.
But I want you to go back and read that. And I want you to study his life and his trajectory. Because, you know, he didn't write that book until he was, late 50s, 60s, I think. I don't want to say that if I'm not right. But he was a school teacher up until then. He had a real job. He had a real job. He was responsible. And then he started telling those stories in bars about his Irish childhood. When you said in your essay to me, what if it's not good enough? Does anybody care about this? Right?
Yeah.
Do these stories belong in the world? The whole essence of Irish storytelling is a way of standing forward, coming from nothing, coming from like abuse and degradation and oppression and poverty and shame and nothingness, like insignificantness, and saying, this story does matter. This story does matter because it happens to me. And Frank McCourt had a wonderful line where he said, I learned the significance of my own insignificant life. He learned that through telling stories.
Yeah.
I learned the significance of my own insignificant life. And that, my dear, is the opposite of grim death. That is real life. That is real life. And that's what you are destined to do. Not just what you want to do or what you hope to do, but I believe it's what you're called to do, and it's sacred for that reason. So I'm going to ask you what you're going to do now. Because I have an assignment for you, but it's a very simple one. But I want your dream of what you want to make and what you're going to do before I talk to you next time and what you're going to do toward that.
I feel very motivated right now. I feel like I want to just literally run down to the closest open mic and start talking.
Don't back away from that. I heard you say it. Don't like qualify it now and be like, but what I really should do.
Maybe I should spend more time alone writing.
Maybe I should work extra hours at my real job. Could you?
Yeah. I mean, it's New York City. There's no shortage of microphones sitting around waiting for someone to get up in front of them for free, you know, put your name in a hat. My logical brain totally gets that. My other side just goes, well, you know, I'm not ready. I'm not ready. But I think it's who's ready? Who's ready? No, we're never ready. So I just need to get out there and start doing it. Any night of the week, I can go and find a place that has people who are standing around and with a microphone. And people, you can go up there and tell 5 minutes.
And they do it after work.
Yeah.
So you can go to your job.
They
don't do it at noon. So you don't need to quit your job. You get to do both of these things. You get to do both, and you get to keep those perks of your lovely job, and you also get to live your real life. And so since you know that you live in New York City and there's no end of open mics and you can get 5 minutes, can I give you the assignment that before I talk to you next time, you're going to do that?
Yes.
Okay. And the other thing you're going to do is you're going to write me a little essay about the history of the Shaughnessy. I want you to really look into that and find out what that position was in society and the importance of that person. And next time I talk to you, I want you to tell me what you learned, because I want you to stop thinking that this is frivolous and start realizing how terribly essential it is. So those are your two assignments. Oh, wait, I had one more. I want you to get a business card made with your name, and I want you to have your job underneath it be Shaughnessy.
Oh, this is totally speaking to my Virgo. Mm-hmm. I get a business card?
You get a business card. Yeah, because that's your real job now. This is your real life. The other stuff is just what you do, because everybody's got to do something. But that I want that to be your new business card. And when people ask you what you do, when you meet them at parties and in airports, I want you to say, I'm a Shaughnessy. And then they'll go, what? And they'll lean in and you'll start telling them, and already you'll be telling them a story, and you'll be telling them a story about humanity, and they're going to be so much more interested in you than if you say, I work in advertising.
Nobody cares about that, believe me.
So business cards, a homework assignment to do research on that word. And next time I talk to you, you're going to tell me what it was like to get back in front of that mic. Okay?
Great. So excited.
You may need to get a phonetic pronunciation for Shaunachie on that card. Oh, that's your other assignment. Next time I talk to you, tell me how that word is pronounced. Because I spent the morning on the internet plugging it into all sorts of things and listening to it 1,000 times and being like, just can't get there. Just can't get there. Cannot work that Gaelic tongue. And the other thing I'm going to do is that I have a magic lessons tradition here, which is that I usually call somebody in for another expert opinion.
Uh-huh.
And so I'm calling in this novelist named Gary Sheingart, who I love so much, who wrote Super Sad Love Story and Absurdistan, and he just wrote this memoir. And the reason I thought of him for you is he just wrote this memoir that has the best title of any memoir ever, called Little Failure. he's Russian, and that was the nickname that his father gave him when he was a child. And, you know, there's a big intersection, I think, between Russian storytelling and Irish storytelling. And that big intersection essentially goes like this. How much worse can things get, and how much funnier and more tragic and great can we make the story once we tell it? And he has a sense of that, about family storytelling and also the sort of deep ethnic kind of very particular ecosystem of being a very specific thing, in the way that you are very specifically an Irish Catholic girl from the Philly suburbs who grew up in a bar. He is very specifically the children of Russian emigres. And he's written about that extensively. And I want to get his advice about family stuff. And I'll also talk to him about what real life means, because I think that's really kind of where we're at with this conversation. So those are your assignments, and it's time to press unmute and to get going on this, because you know it. You know the difference between real life and not real life.
Yes.
All right?
Yes. Wow. Thank you so much.
You bet.
This is amazing.
I can't wait.
This is amazing. Thank you so much. Have a wonderful day, and I can't wait to talk to you again.
Thank you, Colleen. Bye, love.
Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, I'll be talking with the novelist Gary Sheingart about Colleen. But first, a word from our sponsors. No matter where we are in life, learning new things can always be really rewarding, which is why I love having unlimited access to the Great Courses Plus, and I encourage you to try it too. With the Great Courses Plus, you can watch engaging lectures on a wide variety of topics presented by award-winning professors. Learning more about subjects like literature, history, art, or exploring new hobbies like cooking or meditation. And the cool thing is you can fit these short video lectures into your own schedule from any device. One of the lectures that I recently checked out that looks very interesting to me is called The Fundamentals of Photography, where you get to learn from an actual National Geographic photographer about how to take more memorable, aesthetically pleasing photos with techniques like framing, lighting, and composition. So listen, I want to invite you to try the Great Courses Plus today. As one of my podcast listeners, you will have a special opportunity to get a free month of unlimited access to all of the Great Courses Plus lectures when you sign up. You can check out The Fundamentals of Photography, as I plan to, or whatever interests you. Start your free month today by going to thegreatcoursesplus.com/lessons. Remember, that's thegreatcoursesplus.com/lessons.
I'm Travis.
And I'm Andy.
And we host Bunker Buddies, a comedy apocalypse podcast, every Wednesday on MaximumFun.org.
We've got a brand new format for our podcast that we hope you want to come and check out.
We try out products for your go bag.
We'll try out cheddar larvae and cricket bars so you don't have to.
We play Would You Rather and answer questions from the audience.
And we have great guests that pop into the bunker.
It's everything you love about the show and more. Come check it out every Wednesday here on MaximumFun.org. Stay safe out there.
There's always hope and cheesecake.
Okay, we are back. And before the break, we called the vivacious Colleen, the advertising executive who wants to create a one-woman comedic show about her family. We had our private little magic lesson together, but now it's time to bring in the extraordinary writer, Gary Sheingart.
Yeah, hello.
Oh my God, is that Gary?
Hey.
Hi, it's Liz. How are you?
Hey, Liz. How's it going?
It's going well. This is so exciting for me because this is the first time you and I have had a conversation that wasn't on Twitter.
On Twitter. The first time that, you know, tens of thousands of people aren't listening in.
Actually, tens of thousands of people are listening
in. Oh, no. Already? Oh, my God.
Well, not live, but they will be.
I know. Eventually. Yeah.
One of these days, I guess you and I will have a conversation that nobody will be aware of every word of it. But it is not today.
One day I would like to have a non-public conversation.
That would be. I don't even know. How do you do that? What's that even like?
How do you do that? I don't have an audience. I kind of tune out. I'm like, oh, I'm going to do a person. Why?
So we're dealing with the case of Colleen. So Colleen comes from this very particular ecosystem of a family, youngest of six, Irish Catholic, Philadelphia suburbs. Parents owned a bar, and the dad was not just the bartender, but sort of the mayor of the world. A sort of combination of shame and pride at being the bartender's family, and very, like, obviously a rich field for family stories. And she wants to do a one-woman show about her childhood. But she's scared, as people get. And the reason that I wanted to talk to you is, well, it's multifold. But the primary reason is because you wrote one of my favorite books ever. You've written many of my favorite books. But your memoir, Little Failure, as you know from me talking about it on Twitter and quoting huge sections of it on Twitter, it's one of my favorite books in the world. And it's also one of the most complex and richly told family stories. And I feel like there's a link also between Russian storytelling and Irish storytelling. Right? And I
partly fueled by booze.
Fueled by booze and despair and how bad can this get and how good can we make it?
Right.
And you have a line about how all Russian stories come from the edge of the grave. And then there's laughter in that too. So what I want to start with is if you can talk about that, like about coming from a culture that is deeply enmeshed in both tragedy and storytelling and what that means to you personally and what that means to the world at large. So let's just begin there and then we'll take it on.
Well, I think, you know, growing up, my parents would say incredibly tragic things all the time. Even when I was a little kid, they'd say, oh, your Uncle Aaron, he was buried alive during World War II, you know. And as a child, it's a little tough to process that. And in fact, when everything is in such a tragic tenor, you begin to sort of see the whole world as this giant ball of despair. But what my parents did, and this is something I think Irish storytellers do as beautifully as Russian storytellers, I'm thinking of, for example, Frank McCourt, is take all this tragedy and just whack it over the head with humor over and over again until something almost unrecognizably emerges that still has its tragic roots but is now transformed into this subject of entertainment. And I do think that the best way to connect with a person is through entertaining them in some way, not just finding a commonality with them, but saying, hey, let me put my arm around you and let's have a laugh over this horrific thing. You know, your uncle's buried alive, but hey, you know, let's spin that into something unexpected. And so my parents were both really good at relating the tragedy of the world, but also really good at sort of tragedy, comedy, tragedy. There were all these sort of permutations. And I think a lot of my work, the memoir, but all the novels I've written have been an attempt to sort of deal with all these unexpected permutations, to come up with all these unexpected permutations. So that just when the reader thinks, oh my God, now it's time for the waterworks, something else comes along that sort of puts it in perspective. And the idea is almost all parts of humanity come from a tragic background. The history of our species just hasn't been that good. You know?
This is so interesting too, because one of the things that Colleen said when she was talking about what she was afraid of and, you know, why she's not putting it out into the world, she said, I'm afraid that if I talk about it, it's so beautiful what she said and strange, but also I get it. I'm afraid if I talk about it, it will be true. Like all of those things that happened will then really have happened.
Yeah.
And that's such an interesting perspective for me, because I think sometimes we think of storytelling as a way to relieve the burden of that truth. And I wondered if you had any thoughts on that.
Well, as somebody who's been in psychoanalysis for 15 years, I guess there's a lot I could think about it. You know, so this is what sort of storytelling does. I'm writing a novel now that in some ways more in tune with who I am right now. It's more of about a middle-aged guy as opposed to somebody very young. It's focused on mortality in a way that I sometimes deal with, but not always. But, you know, the feeling is that when you do this right, there's sort of two parts to it. One is this incredible feeling of relief. Oh my God, I'm telling this story. I can't believe I'm doing it. And as I'm doing it, I'm ridding myself of some of the psychic harm that's been caused by the actual event. But I think for me, that's just half the battle. And the other half is this feeling of, oh my God, it actually happened. Just as Colleen said, it actually happened. And isn't that incredibly depressing and sort of life draining? But then you toggle between those two, this feeling of elation, being able to tell the story and tell it well, and just this kind of trauma that does get inflicted upon revisiting any kind of material, whether you're in a psychologist's office or you're sitting in front of your laptop. So I think to me, that's almost a sign that things are working when there's this a bit of a kind of roller coaster feel that you're getting it. It hurts, but you're getting it, but it still hurts. But yes, you are getting it. And a day, you know, a couple of hours spent in that, that's why I don't write more than 3 or 4 hours a day, because I think if you're doing it right again, it just drains you quite a bit. I know some writers write a lot more, some write less. But for me, 3 or 4 hours is the point where I am depleted emotionally. Hopefully that's the case. And then I need a swim or a walk or something, a nice, Guinness, but what it works too.
I find it fascinating that when you talk about those two layers of storytelling, of what it does to you, that you begin with the relief and then go to the trauma, because my feeling mm-hmm. is that it would be reversed, that the first thing you would feel is the trauma, and then you would get the relief of having unburdened it. But you start with the relief and then you go into the trauma.
Well, it's interesting, and I wonder if that's partly because, you know, I started writing when I was like 3 years old or something, and I wrote for my grandmother. Well, I wrote my first.
Please tell us the name of the story, because I love the name of the story you wrote for your grandmother.
Well, that story, the novel that I wrote when I was about 5 years old was called Lenin and His Magical Goose. And it was this, I was living in Leningrad in Russia, and I wrote a story about Lenin, who was my hero at that time, because there was a giant statue of Lenin. We were in Leningrad. In the story, Lenin meets this magical goose, and together they invade Finland, and they create the socialist revolution there, and blah, blah, blah. And then in the end, Lenin eats the goose for political reasons. And, you know, it was the kind of story only a Soviet child could write.
It sounds like a 1930s parable.
Well, you know, I mean, it's true, because I mean, what I wasn't realizing as a 5-year-old was that there were some contentious issues in my family, and that the whole, you know, Lenin eats the goose thing had some permutations of, you know, how I was the goose in the story. But what happened was that when I wrote it, my grandmother rewarded me with such love, and she also paid me, I loved this cheese growing up, and she paid me a piece of cheese for each page I wrote this. And a disgusting orange Soviet cheese, this Chernobyl-grade cheese. And every time I wrote a page, I would get rewarded, not just with cheese, but with love. And, you know, love was sometimes hard to come by in my circumstances. Yeah. So in other words, whenever I write something, my initial feeling is, oh, I'm going to get rewarded. You know, so maybe that's why the sequence is a little bit out of sync with the typical, oh, my God, I can't believe I'm doing this. Maybe it's okay. I start out with, I think I'm doing this. I think somebody's going to like me, you know.
I'm going to get a piece of cheese.
I'm going to get a piece of cheese.
And then comes the trauma.
And then comes the, oh, my God, but my cholesterol is 300 or something. He's killing me. The story's killing me. So now I'm incredibly depressed.
Well, I want to talk about fear with you, because your memoir, Little Failure, literally begins with a panic attack.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you could speak to that, because I think it might be reassuring for people who – want to make something and are afraid to know that often that is where it starts.
Well, I think in some ways we all have this one giant story that we have to tell, and then we spend our lifetime telling it in different ways. And so the key is, how do you get to the best version of that story? And the answer in some ways is you never do. You spend your whole life getting to the best version you can, but it's never perfect. And I think part of the fear comes with that, because it's like you've been entrusted with this story that needs to be told, but at the same time, every artist is aware of their limitations. And so you begin to think, am I worthy of this story? So my first book, The Russian Debutante Handbook, a novel that came out in 2002, dealt with a lot of these issues, but it did feel almost a little bit too much. And my next book, Absurdistan, was a novel that kind of shied away from some of these issues. I thought it was a fine book, and it dealt a lot with political themes, and it was a kind of escape valve. It dealt with some of the issues, but it did it in a very offhanded way. And then I wrote another novel which dealt with other issues, but going back to the memoir, Little Failure, was my way of trying to confront, of saying, I was 39 years old when I started, I'm almost 40, I can probably do this. I can probably do justice to this story without any embellishment. But I think you just spend your life sort of doing, you know, this kind of Muhammad Ali ducking and swinging. You're sometimes getting close, sometimes you're shying away from it. It's always in your mind, but you're always a little bit afraid. But it's a part of who you are. And if that fear didn't exist, then you'd be some kind of psychopath. If you were just going to say, oh my God, I'm going to tell the world about my upbringing, my parents, my siblings, about my deepest loves, my greatest regrets, my worst acts. You know, one of the things about writing Little Failure was dealing with the fact that I was often a jerk, that I took the way that I was being treated by people close to me, and I just transferred them onto others. And I'm not talking about as, you know, as a 20 or 30-year-old. I'm talking about as a kid who would get bullied at school but then find the weaker kid and punch him. And to me, that's the stuff that's where you're at your most open, where you're saying, I'm a part of this giant continuum of crappiness. and instead of, you know, instead of ameliorating it, I spent a lot of my life continuing it, making it worse. And that's the truth.
Good Lord. You know, there's the terror that the story isn't interesting enough, and then there's the terror that it's too interesting.
Too revealing. And the practical aspects of just living with family and friends and knowing that they will read it can be very daunting to many people. So people never quite applaud the bravery that is required of this enough, I think. You know, people say, oh, God, they're so narcissistic, they're going to tell this story. But getting up on a stage and saying, this is who I am, I mean, is the story of humanity from the earliest days. Labeling it this or that is pointless. This is what we do, and this is how we retain our humanity, I think.
And it's also, you know, one of the things I was talking about with Colleen is that she used the phrase, my quote-unquote real life, when she was talking about her day job and, you know, working in advertising. And I pointed out to her that somewhere in her consciousness she was aware that isn't, because she wouldn't have said my quote-unquote real life if she really felt that it was. That her real life is on a stage telling real stories to real people in real time, that's real life, and that everything that isn't that is actually just a kind of numbing of the reality. But that's scarier to be real Colleen.
Right, yeah. It's scary to be a real Colleen, but I wonder, and I'm not sure, but I wonder if she came from a kind of background where she came from, I imagine, a working class background, a bar owner, and where you had to succeed on the terms of the world as they were. And being a writer simply wasn't really an option. I mean, you know, my parents always told me it's a fun hobby to have, but you got to concentrate on your law school application. I don't know, Colleen, obviously, but I wonder if there's some feeling of, oh, advertising is, I'm paid for it, so it's real. But this other stuff is just nebulous, and it's in my heart, but it's not on the page yet. Or if it's on the page, it's not on the stage yet. So it's not really who I am.
Gary, how did you push back against that family immigrant expectation that you're supposed to go to law school?
Well, I went to Oberlin College, which is this kind of hippy-dippy school where everyone's an artist.
Yep.
And my,
so that was your start.
That was my start.
Let me just signal to you how much respect I have for going to law school. I'm going to go to Oberlin.
But I told my parents, you know, my parents were spending $100,000 back then, which is basically, like, I'm sure most of their savings or something, to send me to the school. So I said, look, you know, I'll probably go to law school after that. And I felt incredibly bad. I, you know, they weren't rich people. And I said, I'll go to law school afterwards. So my major was government and my minor was creative writing. So I had this kind of set up from the beginning. Government is a kind of pre-law major, or as close to pre-law as I got at Oberlin, where people could major, you know, in Beatles studies or whatever.
Puppeteering.
So, yeah. Uh-huh. my roommate had a class. Students at Oberlin could teach other students. So there was a class in the male striptease that my roommate was taking. And he had, you know, the worst body at Oberlin, which was already saying something. So, you know, each morning I'd wake up and he'd start stripping in front of me. So it was a traumatic experience.
Way to play to type, Oberlin. Thank you for not disappointing.
Oh, it never disappointed. So at Oberlin, I wrote most of my first novel, and it was about the Russian-American experience. Not dealing with it in the same way that my memoir did, but getting there. And so I got a job as a paralegal because I thought, you know, okay, this is a nice way to put some credentials for my law school application. But I was single-handedly the worst paralegal that ever existed because my mind was not on it. And I couldn't, and it was a nice law firm. It was a civil rights law firm. I mean, it was pure and run by Oberlin graduates, and it was as cool a law firm as you would want. But I just, my heart was in this book. But I couldn't send the book out to publishers because I was deeply worried that there were no other Russian-American books about the Russian-American immigrant experience. There were great books by Juno Diaz about the Dominican experience, Jim Bohiri, the Bengali-American experience, Chang Rei Lee, who eventually became my mentor, about the Korean-American experience. But to be the first of my generation to write about the Russian stuff felt like it was airing dirty laundry and that my parents would be incredibly disappointed. And so I kind of worked all these jobs, and then I decided, what if I apply to an MFA program at Hunter College, which was run by Chang Rei Lee at the time, and he was sort of my idol of immigrant fiction because he spoke about the immigrant experience, the Korean-American experience, in such raw terms, this beautiful kind of Whitman-esque prose. He didn't shy away from anything. And so just as a lark, I sent him 30 pages of my book to apply to Hunter, and he called me back and said, I sent this to my editor. I hope you don't mind. She loves it, and she wants to publish your book.
Wow.
And so it was incredibly unexpected. And I remember, you know, walking into my shrink's office and being shell-shocked, and he said something like, if you think failure is hard, try success. And he was absolutely right, because success was, it just was like being punched in the stomach over and over again, because it forced me, all the stuff was now out there. Both my greatest desire and my greatest fear came true at the same time. I was now a published author, and I had a book that was doing very well. But it was very interesting. You know, the book got, I don't know, 50 reviews. 45 of them were really, really good. A couple were mediocre, and one was really bad, from the San Francisco Chronicle. And that was the review that I read over and over again, because I still needed in my mind to be reinforced with this idea that what I did was bad, that I was a bad person for writing it. And I can almost remember that review by heart, even though, you know, Mitch Mitani had written this glowing review comparing me to Salman Rushdie, whatever.
Well, you knew that was wrong.
I knew that was wrong. She probably just got it wrong.
Yeah.
but this woman, whoever she was in San Francisco, got it right. She nailed me. And it took a while for me not to, you know, read subsequent books and not to seek out, to sort of scan through the review. Okay, good, good, good. That's fine. Throw it overboard, and then look for the bad review and say, okay, that's what I deserve.
John Updike said, reading your reviews is like eating a sandwich that may have some broken glass in it. And I just don't, I just don't do it. I just realized it doesn't serve anybody if I'm lacerated on the, you know, in my intestines from that sandwich. You know, one thing I wanted to ask you about before I let you go is there's a lovely line that you have that says, I'm going to quote you to you, Gary, if that's not annoying.
Sure.
But
I love being quoted,
You said, remember this, develop a sense of nostalgia for something or you'll never figure out what's important. Speak to this, and especially speak to this not to me but to Colleen, who comes from a nostalgia-bearing culture as rich as yours, from the Irish who hold that in their veins. What do you mean when you say that?
I mean that desiring to reconnect with the past, whether it's a horrible past or a past that has, and no past is purely horrible, I think, except for a few, a nuanced past, a past with beautiful memories, terrifying memories. The wish to reconnect with that past is such a wonderful thing. It's so human. It's so relatable to others. It is the language by which we communicate to others. Some writers these days especially shy away from anything that can be perceived as sentimentality. They think that writing has to be this kind of cold, hard intellectual exercise. I don't mind writing novels that have ideas in them and discuss politics and the landscape that we live in, the social landscape that we live in. But in the end, you know, it's those moments of connectivity with others. It's those moments of understanding ourselves. And it's those horrifying moments that we want to run away from that really form the spine of our lives and that really form the arc of our narratives. So, you know, my advice to Colleen is to think of those moments, 20, 30 moments, 40 moments, however many she can stomach, however many she can revel in, and to think of that as the basis of what she wants to tell people in a finished product, like a one-person show or whatever she wants to do. It's so, so difficult. Again, I mean, anyone who attempts any of this should get a medal from, I don't know, the American Humanities Association or something. it's so hard, especially the first time around. And I really plead for people who are doing it the first time. But it's not just cathartic. I think it's important to the continuation of our species.
You have a line that I, when I read Little Failure, and then I was up in the middle of the night tweeting about it, that I put on. And I just, before you go, I want to thank you for it, because it's so beautiful. And it's something that when you talk about people being afraid of sentimentality, or which is a way of being afraid of feeling anything, you know, and what are the humanities for if not that, right? But you have the line where you say, when it comes to the world, I want to know it, touch it, taste it, and indefinitely hold it. That's what I think we're here to do.
Yeah.
And that's what made me reach out to you the first time and want to be your friend. was that line, because I thought I could be friends with anybody who wants that, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, that's wonderful, and that's what I want for Colleen and for all of us. So thank you for doing your work from that place and for being brave enough to say that that's what you want.
Thanks so much, Liz. I appreciate that.
Yeah, you're great, Gary. Hey, can I ask you what you're working on this summer? I'm really interested in everybody's summer projects.
So this summer I've been working on the pilot for Supersad True Love Story, which has been bought by Showtime, and working hard on that. I'm loving the whole idea of just thinking about something that was a novel seen through dialogue, which is how a script obviously works. So having a lot of fun with that, and also working on a novel about a guy who loses his mind and goes on a greyhound across the country. And that obviously presents challenges, because I have to go across the country on a greyhound bus.
Oh, I thought you were going to say you have to lose your mind.
That's accomplished a long time ago. Way ahead on that one. Now comes the scary part, which is the greyhound.
Yeah, exactly. The losing the mind part's not as scary as getting on a greyhound.
Oh, no. Been there, done that.
That sounds great. Gary, thank you so much. And from Colleen, thank you. And,
absolutely.
You know, just
good luck, Colleen.
Just keep doing exactly what you keep doing. It's fabulous.
Thank you so much.
All right. We'll catch up some other day, maybe in
absolutely.
In real time.
In real time.
Lots of love, Gary.
Thanks. Take care.
Bye-bye. Gary Steingart, kind and brilliant, is the author of the novels Super Sad True Love Story, Absurdistan, and The Russian Debutante's Handbook. His memoir, Little Failure, is simply a work of genius. You can find out a lot more about him and his work at GarySteingart.com. And since you don't know how to spell Steingart, I know you don't, because I have to look it up every single time I spell it. I'm going to spell that for you. G-A-R-Y, Gary Steingart, S-H-T-E-Y-N-G-A-R-T.com. We're going to take a quick break, but first, a word from our sponsors. Okay, we all live in the modern digital age, and you guys know that feeling you get when you can get something done really easily with just a click of the mouse, and how grateful you are for that convenience. Well, now you can even do that with your mailing and your shipping. You can get it all done without leaving your desk, thanks to Stamps.com. Stamps.com turns your PC or Mac into your own personal post office that never closes. Talk about convenient. Buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter or package using your computer and printer, and then just hand your mail to the mailman or drop it in the mailbox. And you'll never have to go to the post office again, freeing up so much more time for you to be more creative. Right now, sign up for Stamps.com and use my promo code, LESSONS, for this special offer. A 4-week trial, plus a $110 bonus offer, including postage and a digital scale. So don't wait. Go to Stamps.com, and before you do anything else, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in this word, LESSONS. That's Stamps.com. Enter LESSONS. Okay, it's been a few weeks, and now it's time to check in with Colleen.
Hello.
Hi, is that Colleen?
Hi, Liz. How you doing?
I am doing great. How's my favorite Shanaki?
That's exactly the right pronunciation.
Did I do it?
Yes.
I read your essay that you wrote, and I was so happy that you provided multiple pronunciations, which made me feel better about the fact that I couldn't seem to get it.
Well, like most storytellers, nobody can really agree on anything.
Exactly. So how's it going? Why don't you just start talking, and we'll see what you've been up to.
Well, it's been great. I've had such a good time the last few weeks. I went to an open mic night. I just got myself up there and started telling stories, which was really fun and scary and perfectly imperfect.
Wow.
Yeah, really fun, really fun. And I also did a lot of reading. Like, I read so much about the Shanaki, and which just leads down so many amazing hidey holes of Irish, you know, history and lore and storytelling, and It's so rich, and it just made me, it made me feel so great that I was thinking that it was kind of frivolous, and it's just so not frivolous. It's
oh, it is so not frivolous. It is so not frivolous. We are going to take apart all of this, and we are definitely going to go into like a deep dive for you to tell me what it was like to go to that open mic again. But let's start with this idea that perhaps storytelling is not as frivolous as you thought it was. Can you tell us some of what you learned when you went looking into especially Irish storytelling?
Oh, yeah. I it's funny because I started like where you where everybody would start this this day and age. I was on the internet looking around, and of course, you know, conflicting views of everything. And I was standing in my bedroom and I was looking at my wall, and I have a bookshelf there, and I realized that I have about 20 Irish history books sitting in my own bookshelf from my father that I had never even cracked the spine of one of them.
Wow.
Like, talk about...
Literally right in front of your face. Gosh, if only you could have had access to this incredible information in your own house.
Who could find any information about the Irish?
Oh, my God.
So that was that nudge from my parents of like, yeah, we've been training you for this.
Yeah,
let's go.
Yeah.
Crack a book.
And which book particularly did you crack?
There's a book that's called How the Irish Saved Civilization.
I was so hoping you were going to find that book. That book is so good. Everybody should read that book, whether you're Irish or not. It's great.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
It was sitting on my dad's shelf for, you know, since 1995 or something. And then it's been sitting on my shelf for about 7 years. And I kind of thought it was going to be about, like, Irish dancing or something. I don't know what I thought it was going to be about.
Nope.
And it's incredible. I mean, can I just tell you, like,
yeah,
a 20-second view of what it is?
Yeah.
Basically, the Irish, in their kind of pre-literate society, they were just acquiring written language. And this is where the, you know, the Shanachies come in, the pre-written language. They were out telling the stories, telling the tales, passing on the laws, the traditions. But then later, just before the fall of the Roman Empire, the Irish really started to acquire written language and Christianity, and monasteries popped up. And part of the monastic life was transcribing texts. And the monks would transcribe these Greek and Latin classical literature texts. And if they hadn't done that, when the barbarians wiped out the Roman Empire, all of that would have been lost.
Yeah.
And here these Irish ruffians are preserving all of this classic literature that we wouldn't have today.
When the title says How the Irish Save Civilization, they mean it. Literally. Literally Western civilization. This is why we can read Herodotus now. Like, this is why we know what Julius Caesar was up to. Like, this is why we know, because they preserved it on that little dark island. And I have to say, I love this metaphor, because I think it's a really useful metaphor that I often offer to people who are doing work that they feel is helpless against the powers and ravages of the world, right? Whether they're doing social work, or they're doing creative work, or they're doing foster care, or they're doing something where it's like a tiny little drop in a pond, in a great ocean, rather.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like so much of the work that you do for love and for beauty is the work of an Irish monk preserving the classics in a time when no one was literate, when no one cared. It was literally the Dark Ages. And they were holding on to something of beauty and treasure, with the hope that it might be of value later. That is why, like, that's a really good metaphor to have when you're doing something and you feel like it has no impact whatsoever. It does, you know? And there may be a later time where that stuff is considered the great treasures of the world, you know? So yay! Yay! So
yay!
How did that make you feel? Because I know you, like, I mean, so much of what you were talking about was, does this matter? Is this important? Does it have any value? Why bother?
Yeah, I feel completely like a 180 from that feeling, because I do think that when I was thinking about when I was growing up and all the stories I heard that I just kind of thought was like blarney, you know, didn't think it was important. It's I can see all of those through lines through the, you know, I reread Angela's Ashes. I know all those people, you know. I reading the How the Irish Saved Civilization, you know, 5th century. I know those people.
Yeah.
Like, we're connected.
Yes.
It's all the same. You know, centuries have passed, but it feels like yesterday.
And now who gets to be the inheritor of that mantle?
Yeah,
you.
Me.
You. Like, it doesn't, and if you don't, it ends. You know what I mean? Like, and you can't let it end. It's too beautiful to let it end. You have to continue that thread. So I'm so delighted that you have that context for yourself now. And I also loved in your essay where, and by the way, well done to do your homework and write an essay. I love it. I love it. You actually sat down and did it. I was so happy. And it was such a good essay. You get an A.
Thank you. And, oh, and good. One, A for effort.
An A for content, not just
Thank
effort.
You.
But I liked that you said that when you were growing up, you had this idea that Blarney, that wonderful, loose, funny, searching, random, kind of long, extended Irish conversation, that Blarney was synonymous with bullshit.
Right.
And in fact, it isn't. You know, it's actually everything. You know, and so now I want to know, okay, next thing, did you get your business cards made?
I did. They're arriving in a couple of days.
I cannot wait for the first time you get to hand one of those to somebody.
I can't wait either. I can't wait to see the face.
It's so good. And it's going to open up such a more interesting conversation than anything else would. So now that you're rooted in a sort of historical context for the importance of storytelling, and now that you've put yourself in the line of this beautiful and rich and incredibly important heritage, what did you do at open mic? How did that go? And what did it feel like? I want you to walk me through, like, even like choosing what you were going to wear. And like, I want to know what that night felt like. And who was there in the audience? Where did you go? Tell me everything.
It was a Monday night. I went to this great bar in New York City called The Duplex. They've always been a place where singers and comedians and actors, and so it's a very safe space for people to come. And they have an open mic for storytellers every Monday night. And how open mics work, if you don't know, is that you literally put your name into a hat.
Wow.
And then they randomly choose the storytellers out of the hat. So you don't know when you get there if you're actually going to be able to go up on stage.
Uh-huh.
So that was my thinking was, okay, I might not get picked. I'm just going to go because if I don't go, I'm not going to get picked. But if I do go, I might get picked and I might get to go on stage and tell my story.
Colleen, I have to ask you, is there a part of you when you're sitting there that's like, please don't pick me? Please don't
pick
me.
Totally.
Like that you get full credit for showing up and being brave, but you don't 100%. Actually have to do the thing.
I was like, I was so brave. I totally showed up. I wore a cute striped shirt. I get credit for that.
Yeah. And did your name get picked?
It did. In fact, my name was the first one out of
it. Oh, no. Oh, no, God. Oh, my God. That just gave me hives.
But the good thing is that you have no time. It's like they call your name and
yep.
you got to go.
Yep.
Like, it's your turn. Go. And you only get 5 minutes and they have a ukulele. They strum the ukulele if you're running out of time. So it's a little bit of like a pressure cooker. But, you know, leading up to it, I had decided to tell a story that I've told 10 million times mm-hmm. in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem is, to me, telling a 5-minute story is like, I don't even know what, telling me to cut my arm off. And I decided, you know, let me just tell the story about my parents and about, you know, growing up with them and kind of funny, kind of, you know, a little bit heartwarming maybe. And I think it went great. I think it went really well. I mean, it was helpful for me to see how other storytellers do it. Because everyone's different, and I got to see a whole range of people. And for me, I got to go up there, and I was looking in the faces of all of these people sitting in this bar, you know, terrified, but yet it was very supportive.
And
that
also,
was really supportive.
Colleen, it's a bar.
Yeah.
It's literally where you come from, right?
Yeah,
there has
yeah,
to
I
be
feel,
some sense when you walk
I
into
feel
a
very
bar.
Comfortable
like,
in
oh, yeah,
bars.
Home. Here we are. It's so cute that you think I'm going to let you get away with not telling me what that story was about.
Yeah.
Tell me what that story is about.
So the story in brief is about the time that my mother threw an entire turkey dinner into the bay because my father decided to go day drinking with his friends. And he missed dinner.
So no one ate? Not just your dad, but the whole family?
Well, we didn't eat turkey.
Right.
We ended up going out for pizza, which we thought was better.
Right, right.
We were happy.
I like the way that point is made. No one gets turkey when you're day drinking.
Well, to be fair, the turkey was probably ruined by that. He was so late that the turkey, I'm sure, was, you know, my mother was not known for her culinary skills to begin with. So, you know, I think that having a turkey sit in the oven warming for 7 hours probably, or however many hours it was in there, was probably too much to bear. And she and my brother took the whole roasting pan down to the dock and just threw the entire thing, turkey, giblets, potatoes, stuffing, pan, into the bay.
The turkey dines with the fishes tonight. Colleen, you had a vision for your life once of you standing in front of a microphone telling people stories. What did it feel like when you were actually doing that?
It felt, it went so quickly, to be honest, but it did. It felt really like exhaling. You know, I've been holding my breath for a really long time, and I finally got up there and I said, I told it.
Yeah.
I said it.
Yeah.
I did it.
Yeah. Yeah, the stories sometimes won't let you exhale till you tell them.
Yeah.
You know, I always say this when I talk to writers as well. The book wants to be written as much as you want to write it, and it's not going to give you peace until you do it. And those stories want to be told, and they won't let you rest, you know? How many times a day in the last 4 years? How long has it been? Was it 2 years or 4 years since you allowed yourself to do any storytelling?
About 4 years, yeah.
So how many times, how many days in a row in those last 4 years did you think about storytelling?
Oh, every day.
Okay, so for 4 years, this thing is tapping on your shoulder, you know, just saying like, me, 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 like you have to give me attention. And when you finally went up and did it, you could breathe, you know? So now you know what Colleen feels like when she's not telling the story that needs to be told. And now you know what she feels like when she is telling the story that needs to be told. What's it going to look like from now on?
Well, I have to say, it's so interesting because this has been so consuming in a good way over the last few weeks in a way that I never let it before.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't really let myself think about it so much.
Mm-hmm.
And now that I've given myself this permission to really give it this presence in my mind and in my heart, it feels really primary. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
Like before it felt really tertiary.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. What's beyond tertiary? I don't even know what the next one is.
Uh-huh.
But now it feels really
marginalized,
like
right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
It felt really marginalized, and now it feels front and center. And it feels like it's easier for me to make it a priority than it was before. And it's easier for me to put myself into this life than it was before when I was putting myself forward in this other life.
So now that thing that you used to call your real life, where has it been placed now?
Oh, first of all, that was the greatest advice I ever got, by the way, because that helped me immediately when you said, think about that not as your real life. Think about the other part of your life as your real life. I don't want to really sound flippant about it, but it actually gave me almost immediate relief to change my thinking about what I used to call my quote-unquote real life.
Uh-huh.
Because, and not that I didn't care about it as much, not that I didn't pay attention to it and do my work and show up, but that I didn't take it in and give it that primary place.
Right, right. Well, what you've done is you've put everything in the appropriate order, you know? And you're such a great role model because you didn't quit your job, which, of course, you can do anytime. Like people quit their job or not quit their job. That's not the point. The point is, though, if you have a job that you have in order to pay the bills and have enough money to live and blah, 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 and it is not your passion and it does not illuminate you and it does not bring you to life, you do not have to put that in primary central place in your heart. You can put it in the margin, and that's what you've done. You have this thing. It's something that you need to do, but it is not who you are. And now you've put who you are at the center of your day and at the center of your consciousness, which means you get to keep your job and still do your job well, but you haven't made this mistaken, like wrong thinking of what you are. You're not, you know, you said it. You're a storyteller disguised as an advertising executive. And now you've admitted to the disguise and you know what you really are and you know what you're really for. And you can still log in your day job while at the same time being the Shanaki that you were born to be, that you were literally born to be, you know, in every bit of respect. It's so cool. I love that you've been able to do that. And can I take a wild guess? I don't want to ask a leading question, but is it a little easier to go to your day job now?
Oh, yeah, it really is. It really is because it's, you know, it's interesting, like, not that I said this out loud at the office, but every time something would start to go really kind of in a place where normally it would really get me, I don't know, jacked up, I just would say, okay, that's not real. None of you are real.
Right.
I didn't want to say it out loud because I was afraid they might call the, mental people and have them cart me away. But,
no,
you know, it helped because it suddenly diffused all of that energy that I spent so much time putting into it. That's just, you know, it was keeping me from really focusing on what was real.
I have a friend who's an author, and she took a she's a very successful author, and then she took a huge departure from what she normally wrote to write a book just experimentally for fun that she loved, and her publishers acted like, you know, like literally the world was going to stop spinning. Like, it blew their minds, and it broke their systems and their software, like their internal software. They were so hysterically upset and concerned about this.
Like, and broken clocks.
Like they were like, wow! You know, like, they just couldn't focus. And she said she was sitting there in their big giant office in the middle of Manhattan with its windows in the corner office, and she was watching them all just lose their minds because she was telling the wrong story. And she just looked at them and she said, Oh, I see what's wrong here. You guys all still think this is real. All right, I understand. I'm just having trouble figuring out why you're freaking out. Okay. You still all think that everything that's happening in this room is real. Okay,
now we're
cool.
All sorted.
Okay, cool. Then she could like look at them with compassion and be like, I got to go. Like, never mind. I'm going to self-publish this thing, which is what she ended up doing. So I also wanted to ask you how you felt about that conversation with Gary Steingart and if you got anything interesting out of that that was helpful for you.
Yeah, I did. First of all, it's so surreal hearing two people who you respect and admire talking about you.
Isn't that weird?
It's really surreal.
Yeah. Wait a minute. Did they just say my name again? Like, yeah.
I was like, oh, they keep saying my name.
Yeah.
That's so crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, we did because, hey, Colleen, your life matters and your work matters and your art matters. And yeah, of course we were talking about you.
There were a couple things that you both touched on that Gary was saying. And one of them was about, you know, finding those 20 or 30 or 40 moments, like as many as she can stomach, as many as you can remember, and make that the spine of what you're trying to tell. Uh-huh. And that really made a big impact on me because it is true. It's sometimes those moments are really painful.
Yeah.
And it's easier to glom onto the cute ones or the funny ones. But really, sometimes it's that mixture of those really painful ones that you can barely stand to think about.
Yeah.
That are important.
Well, I liked what he said about how, you know it's working when you have that roller coaster feeling,
where
you've got like relief and trauma at the same time.
Right.
You know, you're like, oh, yay, it's coming out of me. Oh, God, it's there it is. I have to look at this thing now. You know, but it's better out than in. You know, I have a friend who always says when she's about to have, when something very painful is about to come out, you know, whether it's in a difficult confrontation with somebody or whether it's in an artistic moment, and she's an artist who's also very emotionally honest. You know, I've had so many moments where I've seen her do this and I admire it so much. Well, she'll just look at the person she's about to say the true and painful thing to and say, it's really scary for me to let this out, but I'd so much rather have it come out all wrong than have it stay in all wrong.
Mm.
You know, and some of our stories just have to sometimes come out all wrong rather than having them stay in all wrong. Because when they stay in all wrong, they do horrible damage to your life, you know. And you letting it come out, whether it comes out wrong or right, you know, better in the open air than in Colleen's subconscious.
Festering in there. It's dark in there.
It's dark in there. Our friend Brené Brown always says, keep your shadow in front of you where you can see it.
Yeah.
You know, it's much safer there than it is inside you where it's doing work on you that, you know, may be very malicious. Yeah, and I also loved Gary saying, take tragedy and whack it over the head with humor until you break it down.
Yeah.
You know, like, look, like your dad day drinking, probably not a joke, really.
You know,
like, you know, like that's, I mean, the turkey going in the bay is funny, but like what point she had been driven to with frustration and rage where that's what it came to, you know, like dark, you know. And that darkness and that lightness right next to each other, that's the beauty of the human life, you know, that is worth telling again and again and again.
Yeah.
Okay, so what are you doing next? I'm curious, what's on the itinerary now?
So on the agenda, well, it's Monday, so I'm going to go back to the open mic tonight.
Yay!
My name goes in the hat at 7:00. I have another story that I've been working on that I want to get up and get out, see what happens. And I'm excited. Like, I actually get really nervous, like, like the day before, like yesterday, I was really freaking out. Like I had the Sunday scaries, which I used to get about work.
Yeah.
But I realized that yesterday I was actually afraid about the duplex.
right.
Which is a better thing to be, yeah, to be afraid of.
Yeah, work is nothing compared to that.
And the other great thing about going to these events is that you meet all these other people.
There you go.
Who are also in that community.
Yeah, you find your tribe.
Totally. Like, and you can tell, I could just tell that all those people, they may not all have known each other directly, but they all kind of knew each other in a way that was very comforting.
Well, you know, all those scenes in all those movies like Close Encounters of the Third Kind, where a bunch of random unconnected people get the call and everyone is like drawn to this one place in the desert for some reason. Like this is what the arts are, you know, and to a certain extent, it's what New York City is. It's one of the reasons I've always loved New York is it's this magnetizing place. And LA is another one, you know, these centers where creative things are happening, Nashville, you know, where like suddenly everybody who's sitting at their office cubicle looking around saying, this can't possibly be real, is drawn and magnetized to a place where everyone else who got that same call also comes. And then they find each other and then, who knows, you might end up making things with them. And that is the coolest journey that you can possibly be on, and you're doing it.
Yeah, I love it. It's great. I'm so excited. I can't wait to keep going.
Yay. Colleen, thank you. Thank you so much for sitting down and having the courage to write that essay and asking to be part of this and for sharing with us who you are and for, most of all, actualizing that vision that you had of yourself years ago, of you standing in front of a microphone telling stories, which, may I remind you once again, was an impossible dream that you have now lived, and that you are now living on the regular every Monday night, and you're an inspiration to everybody. So, yay.
Thank you. I mean, I have to say, honestly, like when I first got the call that I was going to be on the show, I got terrified, like, oh, crap. Now I have to do it.
Yeah. Well, your name got pulled out of the hat, right? But like the only way your name ever gets pulled out of the hat is if you put it in.
Right.
And so just keep throwing your name in that hat and every once in a while it's going to get pulled out and they're going to put you in the spotlight. And that's the worst and best thing that could ever happen. is that you actually have to do it. So lots of love, Colleen. Thank you again. And may you just keep being the Shanike that you were meant to be. Wait, pronounce it for me one more time. I'm not going out saying it wrong.
Shanike.
Shanike. That's who you are. And just keep being that. And it's a great service. And you will continue to help us save civilization. All right, my dear, I think it would be a good idea if we had our civilization look more like what you do on Monday nights than what you do the rest of the week. But just keep going in there and saving yourself and showing us how it's done.
Thank you so much, Liz. This has been the most amazing experience. I really appreciate it, and I'm so happy to be a part of it.
Yeah, we loved having you on. All right, thank you, sweetie.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So that's it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening, and I really hope you'll join us next time. Magic Lessons is a production of the Maximum Fun Network. Michelle Siegel is our extraordinary producer. Our theme music is by Dave Cahill, and it was performed by Dave Cahill and Dallas Vietti. Special thanks to Paul Ruest of Argo Studios and Jesse Thorne of Maximum Fun. You can hear all the episodes and find out a lot more about my comings and goings at elizabethgilbert.com. And of course, if you want to continue your own explorations into creativity, which I really hope you will do, it might help you to pick up my book, which is called Big Magic, Creative Living Beyond Fear, published by Riverhead Books. If you can, please leave us a comment on iTunes. It helps other people discover the show, and we appreciate it. And let's keep this conversation going on Facebook and Twitter. I'm at Gilbert Liz. See you next time.
New York City, listen up. Your fellow Max Fun listeners and hosts are gathering at Stuart Wellington's New Brooklyn Bar, and you're invited. You probably know Stuart from his hilarious movie riffing on The Flophouse, but did you know he's also a small business owner? It's true. Join Stuart and a ton of new Max Fun friends at the Hinterlands Bar on Saturday, August 27th at 7 p.m. You can find more information at bit.ly/MaxFunHinterlands. See you there.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.